This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every week, we help you understand some of the most important news from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, August 14th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Reporters, editors, and other newsroom employees at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette voted to strike this week. It's the latest development in a contract negotiation that has gone on for more than 3 years. Mike Fuco is the president of the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh.
Nobody wants to go on strike, but when that becomes the only option, unless they come to their senses, I think people would rather strike than continue to be treated so horribly by millionaire owners.
WESA's Lucy Perkins has been following this story and joins me now. Lucy, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so my biggest question here is, what happens to the news if reporters go on strike?
That is a really good question, and we don't know the answer to that right now. And, you know, the Post-Gazette is a really big news organization. They've been around for a long time, and the vote this week meant that 123 people who work in the newsroom voted for whether or not to strike. 88 people voted for the strike. And so that means 123 people won't be in the newsroom producing content. And even if the company brings in people to, you know, replace them while this strike is happening, it's hard to imagine that the content won't look really different than it does right now.
Now, I understand that this vote doesn't mean a strike begins immediately. There's still sort of levels of approval it has to go through, right?
Right. So the Newspaper Guild of Pittsburgh, which encompasses, you know, the newsroom at the Post-Gazette, they voted by secret ballot, and those results were announced on Monday. And after they voted, those results were then sent to the local executive council. Once that's approved by them, it goes to the national president of the Communication Workers of America, and he either approves or denies the strike.
Union members have called the Post-Gazette a, quote, hostile work environment. And last fall, they even went on a byline strike. What do they mean by hostile work environment? What's going on there?
Well, a lot has gone on in the last couple of years at the Post-Gazette, which you kind of alluded to. But a really big part of what they were referencing by the hostile work environment is the publisher of the paper, J.R. Block. He came into the newsroom well over a year ago at this point, and it was late on a Saturday night, and he was slamming his hand, allegedly, according to, you know, the newsroom employees who I talked to who were there, and video of the event. He, you know, was hitting a bulletin board and talking about how much money he's pouring into this newspaper and how just how frustrated he was. It seemed to me and to a lot of people that he was frustrated that he wasn't seen in a more positive light by newsroom employees there. But of course, you know, the publishing company and the union has been at odds for over 3 years. The union says that the company is not budging an inch when it comes to things like covering the cost of healthcare increases and things like that. So that one event late on Saturday night impacted that idea of a hostile work environment, but there are other things that have kind of built up over the years and have pushed people to finally vote to strike this week.
People may remember that back in 2018, executive editor Keith Burris, who was installed by publisher J.R. Block, penned an editorial titled Reason as Racism, in which he argued that President Trump should not be called racist and that the word is basically being thrown around to shut down arguments and convey superiority. I mean, how much does sort of the politics of executive editor Burris and the publisher Block play into this controversy with the newsroom?
I mean, it's hard to know for sure because every time I do a story on this, you know, I reach out to the company for comment and I never hear back from them at all. So I can't definitively say how their personal political beliefs or other beliefs are impacting news coverage, but you can definitely see a shift over the last couple of years. You know, their editorials have become much more conservative, which other editors who I've spoken to at the paper have said, you know, it's a pretty sharp right turn from previous opinions and previous editorials that the paper published in years past. It was usually kind of a more left-leaning paper. And there are also some issues that have happened more recently in the last couple of years. We saw two Black journalists at the paper, Alexis Johnson and Michael Santiago. They were both barred from covering protests against police brutality this summer. Alexis was the reporter who was barred first from covering these protests, and they said that she had violated the company's social media policy. Apparently, there isn't a social media policy, so eventually it came out, they said, their decision to pull her was over objectivity concerns. And, you know, the union spoke out and said, this is unacceptable. Management needs to apologize and reinstate both of these Black journalists, and they never have.
And Michael Santiago actually took the buyout and left the paper.
He did. Yeah, he's a photojournalist. He's now at Getty Images. So he's not even at the paper anymore. And he was pretty heartbroken about it. He tweeted about his decision to leave, and he said, you know, I can't work for an organization that doesn't support me and who I am as a Black man. That just happened this summer, but a couple of years ago, we saw Rob Rogers, who is a beloved cartoonist, editorial cartoonist at the paper. He was let go, and of course, the company never made the connection about why he was let go, but he had drawn cartoons that were poking fun at President Trump or decisions that the Trump administration had made. And we know that J.R. Block is a fan of the president and has said that he thinks that the mainstream media has been too critical of the president.
And all of this is happening as people are taking buyouts, leaving the Post-Gazette newsroom. Longtime journalists, people that have been there for decades, are leaving, taking that institutional knowledge with them. And also, the Post-Gazette has contracted its days of printing down to 3 days a week. I mean, is this the beginning or maybe even the middle of the end for the Post-Gazette?
You know, I've talked to a lot of people about this, and what does seem clear is that regardless of how this strike goes, the Post-Gazette is going to look really different after this is all over. And no one is quite sure what that means, what that looks like. But you're right. There have been a lot of buyouts in the last year. We saw executive editor David Shribman. He left. He was beloved by the newsroom. People were really upset when he left the paper. And in July, we saw 14 people in 1 month take buyouts, including one of those reporters was a reporter whose coverage ended the career or contributed to the ending of a career of a local congressman. And that's really impactful reporting. And so it's hard to imagine what news coverage will look like, what accountability will look like if the paper drastically changes.
Also hard to imagine a Pittsburgh without the Post-Gazette, but we will see what happens. Lucy, thanks so much for following this story.
Thanks, Liz.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
It's often said that all politics is local. The same could be said of political coverage. At NPR and this station, our reporters focus on you, getting you accurate facts, answering your questions, bringing you the right experts at the right time. Stay with us to hear how issues in your part of the country are playing out on the national stage this November. 2020 election, it's time to listen to the issues and to each other.
Allegheny County officials say mitigation strategies like mask wearing and limiting service at bars and restaurants are working to prevent community spread of the novel coronavirus. Here's Health Director Dr. Deborah Bogan on Wednesday.
So we hit a nice milestone this past week. For the first time since cases in Allegheny County surged in late June and early July, the weekly average of new daily cases was below 100.
WESA's Sarah Bowden has been watching these numbers, and she joins us now. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Hey, Liz.
The numbers of coronavirus cases in Allegheny County were alarmingly high for a while there. Back in mid-July, we had a day with 331 cases reported. Since then, they have been steadily falling. What can we take away from this?
Well, I think we can take away that a lot of the restrictions on bars and restaurants have seemed to work. We know from contact tracing data that the number one place people report visiting before testing positive is a bar or restaurant, followed closely by parties. These restrictions seem to be mitigating the spread of the virus. Also, I know that some retail establishments have gotten stricter about mask wearing, so perhaps we're seeing the impact of that as well.
It's interesting to me, too, that one of the places that's not cited is daycares. You've got a lot of kids now back in daycares, and yet it seems to be places that adults are going that's really driving the continued community spread.
Yeah, I noticed that, too, and it is fascinating. Perhaps daycares are just doing a really, really good job at keeping everything sanitary and making sure that people wear masks. I think that what it could also suggest is that, at least for younger children, if people are really careful and really adhere to infection prevention and masking precautions, perhaps that's hope for some in-school instruction, but that's a lot of conjecture.
We'll begin to see how that plays out in the next few weeks here. I do want to get back to this point about restaurants, though, because I understand that some restaurants are angry at the requirement that they operate at 25% capacity, that they, you know, can't sell alcohol without selling food. What kind of messaging are we getting from the county in response to these concerns from these businesses?
Yeah, a number of restaurants and bars in the county say that they should be able to operate at 100% capacity, and that they can do so safely, and that they can adhere to masking requirements and physical distancing requirements. But the county's saying, we tried this when we went to the green phase. We tried to allow you guys to operate at full capacity. And, you know, we saw an explosion of cases, and we saw a really poor adherence to masking requirements at some particular establishments. And Dr. Deborah Bogan said on Wednesday that she's fearful that if they loosen restrictions in about 2 weeks, we're going to see another big explosion of cases, and we'll be right back where we started. The county is really, really reticent to loosen restrictions because they feel like they've been there before, been there, done that.
And it didn't work.
It didn't.
So I'm curious, have we seen hospitalizations and deaths surge in recent weeks as a result of that surge in overall cases at the end of June and early July?
For hospitalizations, especially for Black Allegheny County residents, we have seen an increase. We've also seen an increase in deaths. So the spike that we saw late June, early July, we're now seeing the consequences.
Sarah, thank you so much for breaking these numbers down for us and for your reporting this week.
Thanks, Liz.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
StoryCorps, together with 90.5 WESA, is bringing people together for a different kind of dialogue this summer. It's called One Small Step, a project that pairs strangers who don't see eye to eye for a conversation. The goal? To share and listen to the stories behind each other's values. Sign up at wesa.fm/onesmallstep. StoryCorps' One Small Step is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
This week, Duquesne University held its first press conference in response to the demands of Danielle Brown, whose son, Marquis Jalen Brown, died on campus in 2018. Ms. Brown began a hunger strike in early July seeking answers about the circumstances of her son's death, and last Friday, she moved from the Hill District to Duquesne's campus.
Join me. Let's let Duquesne know. See, it was okay that I was starving on Freedom Corner. Now I'm be starving right here at Duquesne. I love y'all for real.
Love you.
Duquesne officials maintain that Marquis, known to friends as JB, broke the window of his 16th floor dorm room with a chair and jumped to his death. Dave Fawcett is one of the university's attorneys.
First, what occurred in the loss of JB Brown was terribly tragic. But what JB did that night that caused his death was also completely shocking to everyone. No one could have foreseen what occurred.
WESA's Ariel Worthy was at the press conference. Ariel, welcome to Explainer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What was Duquesne University's primary message at this press conference on Wednesday?
Yeah, so this was their first press conference, and so their main takeaway was that they had the paperwork and the reports ready for Danielle to see. All they really needed at this point was papers and signatures from her own attorney, and that then they could turn all the files over to her. They also claimed that they did not know that Danielle was seeking more information for an independent investigation until she got here on July 3rd, and that was the first time they'd ever heard anything about this from her. So they also said that she added a fourth demand. Initially, when she got here, she had three demands, which was full cooperation from the university for an independent investigation, body cams for on-campus officers, and for de-escalation training for mental health crises. Now they're saying that she has added a fourth demand, which is a monetary demand, which she denies.
I know you went back to Duquesne's campus to speak to Danielle after the press conference. What did she say about those claims? We'll take them one at a time. What did she say about the claim that she was asking for money?
She was actually very offended about that. She said that she never asked for money. They actually offered her money, and she turned it down. She said that they offered an amount of money that she didn't give it a specific number, but she said it was about what a household would make in a year. And she said that her son is so much more valuable than that. So she said they actually offered the money and she turned them down.
What about this claim that she will have access to all the information she wants as soon as they get her lawyer's signature?
So her thing is that while she might have access to these files and the reports of that night, she's saying that it will lead her to have more questions to where she might have to talk to more people at the university, like maybe the athletic department or housing, and just talk to more people. And when she gets there, she will hit more red tape. And that's the part that she wants cleared, to where she can have access to all of this without having to constantly wait for them to give her the okay to look at everything.
So is she asking for like a legally binding like memorandum of understanding saying like, yes, we will give you whatever you ask for?
Yes. So she's just saying she wants full access to all of this. She doesn't want to have to go bit by bit. And that's what she's waiting for. She's just waiting for them to be able to give her access to everything without any type of blockage, basically.
Did Duquesne respond to that sort of specific part of her demand? And I mean, what are the odds that she's actually going to get that?
They actually did not address that. They just said that they have been more than willing to cooperate and give her what she needs. And they said that they agree with her decision to have an independent investigation and that they will support her in any way that they can.
It's now been more than 40 days since Danielle Brown has eaten. How is she doing?
When I went to see her after the press conference, she was more upset at that time because of some of the things that Duquesne claimed, like her asking for money. However, you can see physically that there's definitely been some changes. She has, like, she's lost a substantial amount of weight. You can tell that the hunger strike is definitely weighing down on her body. And she just seems a little bit more tired and just at this point more frustrated. And you can tell that this is really affecting her, not just physically, but emotionally.
Did you get the sense that her conviction to continue this hunger strike is eroding at all?
Oh, no. This is indefinite for her. She said, you know, she said several times that she's willing to take her last breath here. She's prepared to die during this hunger strike.
Wow. Ariel, thank you so much for following this story and for your reporting this week.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Christopher Ayers is our editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.